Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia, solartopia, solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to
Yeah. Started to burn too many things we found. That's the Gloria Starr Williams singing the Solartopia song with Pete Seeger and David Burns, the theme song of our wonderful show, the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. We are back for another hour with David Swanson, one of the great peace activists of all the world, nominated for Nobel Prize, as a matter of fact, and about to do an upcoming conference on A World Beyond War, author of God knows how many books, and just an all-around terrific guy. David, are you with us here?
Hi, Harvey. How are you?
Great, thanks. How are you? You're talking to us from Charlottesville, Virginia, home of the University of Virginia, and Dave Matthews, among other great assets. And tell us, David, I'm going to start. I want to talk to you about your theories on just war, and about how we're going to stop war. We have a full hour to deal with. It's really great. I want to thank PRN and the folks in the studio in New York for setting up this special session with you. But let's start by describing this conference, and we'll finish by describing. Give us your website, and then tell us about this upcoming conference you're going to have in Washington, D.C., if you would.
Yeah, and thank you for saying Dave Matthews instead of Thomas Jefferson. That's big improvement. I'm working with a whole lot of people and organizations and great speakers like yourself who will be speaking at the conference. It's called No War 2016, and this will happen from September 23rd to 25th in Washington, D.C., with workshops on the 25th and a training planning session on the 25th. For a nonviolent protest at the Pentagon on the morning of the 26th. And the list of speakers and organizations and topics is endless. You can find it at worldbeyondwar.org. You can register there to attend if you can be in Washington, D.C. those days. We're about to cut off registration for Friday because the space is filling up, but people will still be able to sign up for Saturday and Sunday. Or you can watch the live stream at therealnews.com anywhere you are, and there are events being set up around the world to watch that live stream. Or we can help you organize an event of your own or help you improve and build on a local International Day of Peace event in your part of the world, because this is, of course, the same week as the International Day of Peace. So that's a big conference we're working on, and we're looking forward to hearing you talk about connections between the natural environment and war and ending war. But the general theme of the conference is, well, what do we do instead? What do we replace war with if we're going to abolish it? How do we make ourselves safe and handle foreign relations and conflicts nonviolently and establish the rule of law and a sustainable solartopia? Which is also the topic of a book that World Beyond War produced last year and is producing an improved second edition to be handed out at the conference.
What's the title of the book?
It is called an alternative global security system. I hope I'm saying that right. Let me get to you. You can actually read the whole first edition if you're inclined to read things on the internet on the website of worldbeyondwar.org. And in a second here, I'll actually find it. A global security system, an alternative to war. This is last year's first edition, which has been significantly improved now. But you can read that on the website worldbeyondwar.org. And The new edition should be there right about the time of the conference, and if you're at the conference, you'll get a free copy.
All right, so tell us about this conference. You've been gracious enough to allow me to speak. What other speakers do you have that people can look forward to hearing?
Well, I hope people know many of the names. Dennis Kucinich, former Congress member. Kathy Kelly, great peace activist with Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Miriam Pemberton, leading advocate and policy worker on transition, on working with government programs to transition economies locally from war industries to peace industries. David Vine, who's a professor there at American University, which is hosting the conference, who has a wonderful book and has been working for years with activists around the world resisting U.S. military bases, construction and maintenance in places all over the world where they are routinely protested in Italy and Germany and Japan and Korea and on and on. Kozue Akibayashi, who's coming from Japan, she is the president of Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. The great Harvey Wasserman is next on the list. Jeff Bachman, Peter Kuznick, Medea Benjamin, Maurice Carney, Leah Bolger, on and on, dozens and dozens of speakers, activists, authors, government officials, every sort of expert and inspirational organizer, and there these will be panels with discussions, but then there will be workshops on a number of campaigns, really getting down to planning work on moving this culture toward the abolition of war and abolishing particular aspects of war.
Well, that's a small undertaking. What makes you think that we can actually get rid of war? What's the key? What's the magic here?
Well, I count on you to make the predictions and the optimistic declarations based on, you know, your source of belief in happy endings. But I make no predictions. But if we don't try to end war, I mean, we're committing mass suicide. The risk of nuclear holocaust spreads with every minute that we maintain these nuclear weapons in a growing list of nations, and the United States is leading the charge in building new nuclear weapons and putting more nuclear weapons into other countries in Europe pushing for the more usable, as they call them, smaller nuclear weapons and so forth. The hostility that's being kicked up by this new Cold War and aggression toward Russia and China risks nuclear holocaust and so-called conventional war escalation. There's a crying need for a massive investment, as you know, in sustainable green energy, and there is only one place that money can come from, and it happens to be the same place that is itself the greatest destroyer of the natural environment, the greatest consumer of petroleum, the third greatest polluter of U.S. waterways, the number one greatest creator of Superfund sites, the greatest polluter of land, water, and air around the planet, the U.S. military. We're talking about $1 trillion or so a year just in the U.S. military, and another trillion or more in the rest of the world put together. Take a fraction of that, and you can transform our dreams of green energy and everything else that's useful, from food to water to medicine to education to housing. We need to take the money out of the war machine, and if we don't do that, we're risking apocalypse. So it's self-interest, it's necessity, it's not indulgence or luxury here. Whether we will succeed or not, who knows? But we have to try.
Well, it's certainly an amazing undertaking, and it's definitely a wise work. There's no doubt about it. Have we made, in your opinion, has the human race made any progress towards abolishing war, or are things as bad or worse as they've ever been?
Well, it's hard to talk about the human race when 4% of the human race here in the United States is so dominating the destruction of the environment and the proliferation of weapons and war. Some other parts of the human race are doing just fine, thank you, and there are nations without militaries and with very limited militaries and that haven't gone to war literally for centuries. But this little bit of the human race here in the United States is having a bit of a struggle, and it has made some progress, right? You don't hear the sort of talk that you heard from Teddy Roosevelt about, let's have a war, I don't care against who, a war would be good for us. You know, there's always this pretense now that a war is a last resort, and the propaganda has to push it that way. And it's even gotten to the point where to reach a certain segment, a significant fraction of the U.S. public, you have to present the war as humanitarian and philanthropic and pretend it's some sort of rescue operation, at least at the beginning, before it becomes all about overthrowing governments and killing people. And so those are, in a way, progress. But as long as you're willing to believe the new improved propaganda and let the wars roll on and let the military spending roll on, well, you've got problems. Now, there are big pushes from the rest of the world. The United States just yesterday said it's, you know, the last company supposedly that's manufacturing cluster bombs in the United States is going to cease to do so because of global pressure, while the United States is still not going to sign on to the treaty with the rest of the world to ban the things. You know, these sorts of steps are happening. The rest of the world is pushing for a ban on nuclear weapons, and that's going to bring pressure on the nuclear states. The movements around the world against bases and against militarism are making some progress, and cultural and theoretical developments are in the works too. This past April, the Catholic Church, of all places, of typically, you know, regressive, reactionary resistance to cultural progress, convened a meeting to discuss rejecting, after, you know, nearly two millennia, rejecting the doctrine of a just war, that there can be such a thing as a just war, and proceeding to work for nonviolent only means of resolving conflicts and working proactively for a just peace, as they call it, instead of a just war. And I spoke with one of the with a woman who was at that meeting in April. I spoke with several people who were there, but this woman said it really struck her that the people who had come out of Catholic seminaries in Africa and Asia and the rest of the world hadn't really heard of just war theory, didn't really know what it was. But everybody who had come from the Catholic churches and seminaries in the United States and Europe, it was all they had been taught about decisions around war and peace, was just war theory. Well, it's a, you know, this is something that came out of St. Augustine back when the Catholic Church was joining up with the Roman Empire, and was further developed by Thomas Aquinas. You know, these were people who favored monarchy and slavery and, you know, thought you shouldn't resist dying because you'd get to a better place sooner and so forth. You know, a whole world view that across the entire spectrum of issues, from women to sex to animals to diet to medicine to politics, you know, has nothing in common with how anybody thinks today. But this particular vestige of their worldview has hung on, you know, way past its expiration date. You can have a just war. It's in every U.S. University and think tank and institution and pro-war congressional office. And yet the Catholic Church is now way ahead of the the ethics classes and the philosophy departments in the United States.
Pretty amazing. We're talking with David Swanson here, one of the great activists of our time on the issue of war, a small little detail that seems to plague the human race without end. The upcoming conference that he's organized is War Without End. It's going to be in Washington, D.C. What are the dates on that, David?
September 23rd to 25th is the conference, and the 23rd is almost full, if not full, so sign up right away. And the 26th is the protest at the Pentagon.
And by full on that Friday, how many people do you have coming?
Well, we have a big room at the American University School of International Service called the Founders Room, and they've told us we can fit 160 people on Friday, and we may be over that now. I have to go check periodically because I'm going to cut it off, but we can expand into a larger space and have 200 people on Saturday and Sunday, and for part of it we can have 300 people, so it's still possible to sign up for those days. And this nonviolent action on the 26th is part of a series of hundreds and hundreds of actions that will be happening all over this country and the world, being organized and promoted by a group called Campaign Nonviolence. So you can check out their website and find the list to find a nonviolent action this same week, wherever you are, or create one and we'll help you promote it. We also, World Beyond War, is organizing a similar conference at the same time in Berlin, Germany, and we're working with people in a number of countries to hold events to watch the live streaming from therealnews.com of the conference in Washington. And then there's another big conference of the International Peace Bureau in Berlin right after this, and then big peace marches coming up in Germany and in London and in Ireland around October 8th. And so there's if you go to the events page on worldbeyondwar.org, you'll find just a whole smorgasbord of actions that the peace movement is planning this fall, which I think is a very, very good and encouraging thing. This level of growing activism, even during the real heat of the distraction election season, combined with this growing trend of sitting out the national anthem, is giving me some encouragement.
It is quite amazing, isn't it? Is there a specific historical reason for having these conferences and actions at the end of September?
Well, the International Day of Peace, which is, not that many years old, but has been around for a number of years now as a UN-recognized international day for peace that is, widely celebrated around the world, is happening September 21st, as it always does. And Campaign Nonviolence organized a week of nonviolent actions that same week last year and is doing the same again this year. And students are back in school, and so it's a way to bring young people into an event with older people on college campuses and other locations. So it seemed like a good time for us to bring a message to the public in Washington, D.C., when we've heard this week and we're going to hear again next week from the two least popular major party presidential candidates in history, war, 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 and more war. So we're going to explicitly suggest some alternatives to that bipartisan vision.
Well, it is astounding. And since you raised it, let's talk about that, and then we'll talk about your a new essay on just war. But we have a national election campaign, basically. It's Mussolini versus Margaret Thatcher. And what are your thoughts as a peace activist, as one of the world's leading peace activists? What do you make of this astonishing election between these two roundly hated people?
Yeah, I think you characterized them almost perfectly. Mussolini or a bit of Silvio Berlusconi in there versus, Margaret Thatcher with maybe a touch former Secretary of State, killing half a million children was worth it. Madeleine Albright, maybe a shade of Henry Kissinger. I mean, these are disastrous candidates, horrendously awful candidates. One of them, nominated by the U.S. corporate media cartel, who thought it would be good for their ratings to put his entertaining demagoguery on our screens endlessly until every other Republican candidate was drowned out. The other, chosen by a completely corrupt political party, and that corruption, obvious to many of us, exposed in emails of DNC staffers going back and forth strategizing how they could defeat the other candidate in Bernie Sanders, and that hardly makes a blip in the news, which jumps back to some other obnoxious thing that Donald Trump just said. So you have a you have a system that people say, aha, the establishment is falling apart because, you know, the controllers of the world in their smoky room would never have picked these two, especially Donald Trump. But that's not, you know, how it works. That doesn't mean we're an inch closer to democracy. This is, you know, the result of a broken communication system, a corrupt party system, and their mutual collaboration, and it shuts out the voters and the public and the interests of you and me. You know, of course, even if we had a working election system, it would be a minor factor in the sort of activism that's needed to change the country and the world. It's not where all of our obsessive attention should be going. But in terms of the election, I think the useful things you can do are, number one, promote and vote for Jill Stein. Number two, promote and demand and protest and lobby and agitate for open debates that put four candidates that the public favors having in the debates instead of two, which is something that any media outlet can do simply by saying, I decline to bow down to a corrupt and absolutely extra-legal organization created by the big two political parties for their interests alone, contrary to the interests of journalism, democracy, or even ratings, because they would get better ratings if they put four candidates in there.
Yeah, and it's interesting, there actually are four candidates who are somewhat on the radar screen. I mean, you have Gary Johnson, the libertarian, former governor of New Mexico, who is a self-proclaimed pothead. I mean, the guy is very conservative. His politics are not in any way, shape, or form particularly amenable to human survival on this planet, and I haven't heard him speaking about war. I will say he's showed in some polls now around 10%, which is and has forced the networks to acknowledge his existence. I will say, by the way, he is an avid pot smoker, Gary Johnson, but he has promised to not smoke pot if he's elected president during his presidency, which I think is a mistake. I mean, I think we really need a stoned president, for God's sakes. And then there's Jill Stein, who I will be seeing tomorrow here at Capital University in Columbus, Ohio. And what do you think of Jill Stein, David Swanson?
Oh, I've been a friend and admirer of Jill Stein for years, as I'm sure you have. Please say hi to her for me tomorrow. I've been her Secretary of Peace in her shadow cabinet, and we've worked together and spoken together, and I've been unofficially helping out her campaign a tiny bit when asked. I think she's got the right positions on just about everything, and to have such a person whose platform is amenable to human survival and flourishing on the stage with three candidates who don't fit that description is just far superior to having only two people on the stage, neither one of whom has a platform amenable to human survival. So, you know, it's not that I want to add Gary Johnson. It's that I'd rather have four with one good one than just two bad ones alone. But, you know, Jill Stein has been doing her best up against, you know, a completely corrupt system that we've watched what it did to Bernie Sanders and how he, in the end, bowed down before its power. You know, she's up against stiff odds, but it's not the same situation as it was 4 years ago or ever before, because these two candidates are less popular than ever before. People are more fed up than ever before. People identifying as independents are more of the population than ever before. So, you know, we're up against the media. And if we can use independent outlets like this one to talk to each other sufficiently to tell each other, I'll go vote for Jill Stein. If you'll go vote for Jill Stein, let's all go vote for Jill Stein together. Then who knows what might happen? And it might be possible to get her in the debates, and then that would completely change the conversation. You saw—I don't know if you saw that so-called town hall that CNN did with Jill Stein. I mean, it's completely scripted, pre-approved questions and so forth, and they would cut her off with, "So do you believe in vaccines?" or "So do you believe in God?" every time she got going. But she got going on important topics that had been completely absent from a year and a half of a so-called campaign for president in a so-called representative democracy. It would be a completely different discussion that neither Hillary Clinton nor Donald Trump wants. If there was a way to get one of them to want it, if it was like getting Reagan to want John Anderson in the debates, you know, that would be the way to open the door. But I don't see how to make that happen, except for the fact that Trump is completely unpredictable. I don't see a way to get Hillary or Trump to see that it's in their interest to have far more popular opinions put into the debate.
Right. Well, you would think Trump would probably want Jill Stein, and Hillary would probably want Gary Johnson. I would only want Gary Johnson on if he promised to be stoned when he went on the panel, but I'm not sure we can arrange that. So we're talking with David Swanson, the great author and organizer of World Beyond War. David, you have, well, it's hard to leave the campaign, but God, I will say one thing, though, in all fairness. I do repeatedly compare Hillary Clinton to Margaret Thatcher, but Margaret Thatcher, among the many other things about her that were horrifying, she was a really vicious homophobe, and she gave a lot of speeches against being gay, and we have to concede that Hillary has never done that. Hillary, on the other hand, will be commanding.
I'm not going to concede that with you, Harvey.
Oh, yeah? You're not? Okay. Well,
no,
I've never seen you give...
I don't know how vicious or how provoking of violence and so forth, but Hillary, you can watch endless videos of Hillary Clinton back in the day saying marriage is for a man and woman and I don't support such things and on and on. And people have made compilation videos showing her change of opinion and position and votes over the decades. And I think that's to her credit. I don't hold that against her. If you're going to be an elected representative in a republic, that's exactly what you're supposed to do. But I think it's a lesson to activists that what needs to change is the culture, not the faces in the high offices. You know, you don't get Hillary Clinton supporting gay rights because it's Hillary Clinton. You get Hillary Clinton and other people who blow with the wind like Hillary Clinton supporting gay rights because the whole culture was changed and made that necessary.
I guess you can say that. It'd be interesting to ask somebody who knew Margaret Thatcher if they thought at some point she would, you know, come over. I mean, the great example of people changing their minds, politicians, always changing their public stance is George Wallace, who was the extremely racist governor of Alabama, who then later in his career ran as an integrationist, for God's sake. So how sincere he was in either position, I guess we'll never know, and we'll certainly not know had Margaret Thatcher lived if she would come around on the gay rights issue. But you're certainly right that Hillary's positions have been morphed, let's put it that way. She's also, this is one, I don't think anybody believes that if Hillary Clinton got to be president, she would oppose the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which she's doing now. But there's no way if she became president, she would be against that treaty. And I have to put in here, by the way, that I think that Bill Clinton was one of the worst presidents in the history of the United States. I don't put him down there with the real, real serious psychopathological bigots like Richard Nixon, Woodrow Wilson, Andrew Jackson, Andrew Johnson. Those are my four least favorite presidents. Next is George W. Bush. I'm not sure that the term racial bigot applies to him, but Bill Clinton was just a horrible president. He did so much damage and continued. I can't stand the sight of Bill Clinton, frankly. You know, this is a guy who was thoroughly briefed on the Leonard Peltier case, the Native American who's been locked up for 46 years for crimes he obviously didn't commit. And Bill Clinton just turns my stomach. So Hillary does too, to a certain extent, and it is an abominable election. And Bernie did kind of disappear on us here. He never really raised the issue of permanent war. I mean, I think if there's any single issue, any single problem that faces the United States of America, it's the problem of permanent war. I mean, what the hell are we doing in Afghanistan? It makes no sense whatsoever. It's like a joke, and Obama to have signed on to this war really puts the stamp, the official stamp of approval on the fact that we will be in wars as long as they can prolong them, which makes absolutely no sense. Not even a remote possible justification for our presence in Afghanistan beyond the need of the ruling elite to have a war going on. Wouldn't you agree with that?
Yes, of course, and it's quite open. I mean, I've been writing about articles in the Politico and the Capitol Hill newspapers and in mainstream U.S. newspapers where Pentagon officials just openly now talk about these wars as being for profits. Sometimes they say jobs, often they, or more honestly, say profits, and for bureaucracy, for the military's desire to exist and expand, and the same with NATO. The current lies about Russian military superiority, which are as, you know, ludicrous as they've ever been, openly admitted by Pentagon officials, are just concocted for interests of profit and interests of bureaucratic aggrandizement. And this is, you know, what drives the wars. There's no definition of what success will be, when success might be reached, what would be involved in ending the wars. And once the wars are started, nobody really makes a push for ending them. So you now have the United States bombing and with troops on the ground in at least seven countries, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Yemen, Syria, and a president who brags about having bombed seven countries, and people can't even keep track of the wars anymore, and there's just no thought of ever ending any of them. And you have, you know, good liberal progressive friends of mine telling me, well, you should vote for Hillary Clinton because she's not an overt racist. You know, as if this is the standard now. You know, this is the qualification for being president. You're not an overt racist. But what does it mean to bomb seven predominantly Muslim, predominantly dark-skinned countries, and to talk about it sociopathically as a jobs program? You know, I watched this this guy who was the U.S. ambassador to the Soviet Union when the Soviet Union fell, and it was on a panel with Vladimir Putin recently, and Putin said, what about all these troops being put on our border and these exercises and new missile bases in Romania and Poland, and NATO expanded right up to Russia? This is, you know, an unprecedented threat to Russia. And this former ambassador said, oh, no, you misunderstand. This has nothing to do with threatening Russia. This is all for U.S. jobs. You know, as if Khrushchev could have said that those missiles in Cuba are just for jobs back in the Soviet Union. Right. And Kennedy would have said, oh, okay then. You know, but that's what people in Washington tell each other to say to each other. And they got themselves convinced it makes some sort of sense, and they go out there and say it, and the rest of the world is horrified.
It is astounding. And I think it's actually gone beyond that, David Swanson, author of World Beyond War. It's more than jobs. It's almost like a psychological state of mind that certainly since Iraq in 2003, and really to a certain extent since the end of World War II, the United States has become psychologically addicted to being in a war. It's like we're disoriented if we don't have a war going on.
Yeah. I think that's absolutely right. And when the Soviet Union fell and well-meaning, smart liberal people said, oh, well, now the wars will stop and we'll get a peace dividend and so forth, completely misread the underlying motivation. The commie threat was an excuse. It wasn't the motivation. If absolutely impossible to actually happen, but if global terrorism were actually to end, and of course it won't with a war on terrorism that is terrorism and provokes more rather than less terrorism, but were it to end, people would also say, oh, well, now the military budget will go away and the wars will stop and we'll bring all the troops home and so forth, to completely misread the situation. And if all the industries were to be nationalized and the profits taken out and the whole mega profitable industry of dealing in death were done away with, people would say, oh, well, now the wars will stop. No, the underlying motivation, which has been there since before 1776, has been to expand and dominate the globe through violence. I mean, this has been the modus operandi of the United States since before there was a United States, and it's never let up. And until that worldview that says we are going to come and dominate you by force, whether you like it or not, and some people will now say it's for genocide, while others will say it's for humanitarian purposes, but it doesn't make a hill of beans difference to the people on the receiving end of the bombs. Until that's done away with, we're not going to end war. We're not going to end these conflicts. We're not going to end this weapons proliferation. I think it is in large part the profit that drives the arms industry. The U.S. is the top supplier of weapons to the rest of the world, and those weapons are often used against the United States in its wars and on both sides of its wars and so forth. So profits is a huge factor, but it is the underlying mindset that says we must have wars that is the chief problem here.
Well, actually, I'm in the process I'm going to be sending you. I'm almost done with the draft that I can send you of my next book, which is called America at the Brink of Rebirth, and the subtitle is The Organic Spiral of U.S. History. But one of the themes is that the United States is really born of two parents, and one is our Native American ancestry, which is never dealt with in any real respectful way except by Howard Zinn and a couple of other professors, but even the leftists tend to say, well, it's terrible that the Indians were wiped out, as opposed to really looking at the contributions of Native American society. And the other, our father, our godfather, is the Puritan, the Puritans who came to Boston in 1630. And these guys really did preach permanent war, and totally racist, and global domination. The whole idea of the city on the hill was as a Puritan, Calvinist, angry God kind of totalitarian state, basically, that whose purpose was to subdue the entire planet, conquer nature, and force everybody to become basically a Puritan. So you're 100% right on that. And you also, David Swanson, have written about this whole idea of a just war. Can you talk to us a bit about the dialogue that's going on between those Christians, Catholics in particular, who have a doctrine of just war and your repudiation of that?
Yeah, of course. And by the way, I've had as a guest on my show recently a woman named Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, who wrote a book called An Indigenous People's History of the United States, which I'm sure you're familiar with, but I highly recommend that one too. I have a date to debate or discuss just war theory with one of its advocates at a university in Vermont in a couple of months, and I started jotting down my thoughts, and it developed into a book-length thing, and I'm about to publish any day now a book called War Is Never Just that makes the case that you can't have a just war, that we need to abolish war, and that if you examine the criteria that they lay out for a just war closely, one by one, you come away more convinced than ever that we can and should abolish war. And, for for every war that even the just war theorists argue was just or might have been partially just and so forth in the past. Some of them go so far as to not even claim there's ever been a just war, but there might be one someday. But for every just war that anybody claims as just, there have been dozens and dozens and dozens of wars that nobody makes that claim about, you know, that you've got a general consensus this war was evil. And when you're dumping, again, $1 trillion, a fraction of which could solve all problems of hunger and thirst and basic health needs and so forth, when you're dumping that into preparing for wars, and it makes the wars happen rather than preventing them, you know, you have to factor into your calculation about any particular war and your theorizing about possible future wars the impact of maintaining that industry. So, you know, even if there was a way to have a just war at some point in the future, it would have to be so good, it would have to do so much good and eliminate so much evil to counterbalance the unfathomable harm done by dumping $1 trillion a year into militarism and all the unjust wars that that brings with it. You know, and we've developed over the past century in particular incredible knowledge and skills with nonviolence that weren't known before, so that it has become really undisputable that in most cases, in terms of domestic tyranny, nonviolent approaches are far more likely to succeed, and if they succeed, those successes far more likely to be long-lasting. And we're beginning to see a body of cases suggesting great potential for the same tools in resisting foreign occupation. It's still a much shorter list, but foreign occupations resisted successfully by nonviolence. And when that starts to become a possibility, then you can't say, well, we should have tried violence instead, with all the death and injury and trauma and instability that that creates. I mean, nobody goes back and says, you know, 5 years ago, Tunisia should have overthrown its nasty government with a war instead of a nonviolent movement. You know, you could go back and make a just war theory case, but you can't do it now because they succeeded, you know, with flaws, but they succeeded with nonviolence. It's obviously superior. And so to make a case that, you know, one of the criterion that they always use is last resort. Well, there's always another nonviolent approach that could be tried. You never run out of resorts. You know, when they say we have to hurry up and attack Iran, and others say, well, let's just not attack Iran for another year and have a nuclear agreement instead. Or, you know, President Obama says we urgently need to bomb Syria as a last resort. And everybody says no. And he says, oh, well, let's have an agreement on the chemical weapons instead. I mean, it's never really a last resort. And if you look through all of the criteria that the just war theorists tend to use, some of them, like proportionality and right intention and so forth, can't be measured. You know, I can say you shouldn't have blown up that guy and 14 children along with him, and somebody else can say, oh, that guy was worth blowing up to a tune of 18 children along with him. There's no actual empirical or definable measure to what's proportionate and what's not. It's just in the eyes of the war makers. So you can't actually use just war theory to support or oppose a particular war. And others of the criteria are just impossible to meet at all. You can't have a last resort. You can't have non-combatants immune from attack. They're the majority of victims in most wars. You can't have enemy soldiers respected as human beings while you're trying to kill them. This is not how we respect other human beings. And then they have other criteria that just have nothing to do with morality at all. You know, the war must be waged by a legitimate, competent authority and publicly announced and so forth. Well, you know, this is cover for saying that certain governments get to wage wars and others need to have wars waged against them. It's not actually a set of moral criteria for having a good war or a just and necessary war. This is a doctrine, a body of theory that has just played out its usefulness. It's from an age that's long gone, and we shouldn't be pushing it on our young people in our schools anymore.
Okay, so then the key question, of course, the inevitable question you get is the war against Hitler. And World War II, the only war in American history, by the way, in which there was a clear majority of support. I mean, during the Revolution, there was about one-third for, one-third against, one-third didn't care. The Civil War, obviously, the country was divided. Very clearly, the majority of the American population was correctly opposed to U.S. involvement in World War One. Certainly in Korea, Vietnam, massive divisions, Spanish-American War in particular. But World War II, okay, you've got this guy Hitler. What do you say about World War II?
Well, what I say about World War II can go on for hours and hours, and I think it almost has to because the myths are so deeply ingrained. It is the number one topic of U.S. entertainment, of U.S. culture. It's almost a foundational myth of our country. It's not 1776, really. It's 1941 now in most people's minds. And so it's going to be hard to touch on in the next few minutes, but it's dealt with in my forthcoming book, War is Never Just, but, to just scratch the surface, it couldn't have happened without World War One, right? Without the stupid manner of starting and ending World War One, which led to numerous predictions of World War Two on the spot. Without Wall Street's funding of Nazi Germany for decades, without the arms race, without all kinds of bad decisions that were not required by some sort of genetic or mystical or historical force. It was not a surprise attack on the United States by the Japanese. President Roosevelt had promised Churchill that he would work hard to provoke Japan, and he did so, and the United States government took numerous steps to do so and knew the attack was coming, and FDR predicted it. It was off by 6 days in a prediction to his cabinet. Before Pearl Harbor, he had built bases in the U.S. and across oceans and traded material to the Brits for bases on islands. He'd started the draft. He'd created a list of every Japanese-American person in the country. He'd provided planes and trainers and actual pilots to China for the war. He'd put harsh sanctions on Japan as part of the provocation. He had advised the U.S. military that it was at war with Japan, pre-Pearl Harbor. The war was not humanitarian in any sense, was never marketed as such until it was over. There was never a poster asking you to help save the Jews. A ship of Jewish refugees was chased away from Miami by the Coast Guard. Other nations and the United States had meetings and decided not to accept any Jews. Peace groups went to Churchill and his foreign secretary and said, take the Jews out of Germany on ships. And they said, Hitler might agree to that, but we can't be bothered. It's too much effort. It's too many ships. We can't do it, even though the British had just taken 340,000 of their troops off the beaches in Dunkirk in 9 days. It was perfectly doable. They had absolutely no interest in it, took no military or diplomatic step to help the people in those camps whatsoever, had nothing to do with the war until after the war. War was not, of course, defensive for the United States. Nobody was attacking the United States. Nobody was going to be attacking the United States in the future. FDR lied about having Nazi plans to carve up South America, to eliminate religion from the world. He lied about U.S. ships being innocently attacked when they were actually assisting British planes, just as Woodrow Wilson had done. Now, you can make a case, and this is where people make the strongest case. The U.S. had to get in to defend other countries that had gotten in to defend yet other countries. But did it, and did it help, or did it prolong and escalate and worsen a war and take it to a point, a new low in war making that has lasted ever since, of all-out war on civilians, total destruction of cities that led to many people who had supported the war at the beginning opposing it and resisting it and going to prison for resisting it. Of course, people at the time did not know what we know now about the ability of using nonviolence. But you look at what was done against the Nazis in Scandinavia, in Eastern Europe, in Berlin, in Rosenstrasse, these nonviolent efforts that were incredibly successful and then didn't build on those successes, didn't have any sort of plan or organization like they should have. I can go on and on with dozens and dozens of reasons why the war was not what we think it was, and I'll be glad to if you want me to.
Well, I'll agree with you that the war wasn't what we think it was. The question is, how would nonviolence have fared against Hitler? How would there have been, and this is an important question because we would expect a Hitler to come back again at some point in our history. Clearly it's not Putin. I don't see one, I see a lot of smaller guys mimicking Hitler in many ways, but how would nonviolence have worked against him? And it wasn't, of course, advocated by Gandhi, and the Brits locked him up for it. So how would nonviolence have worked against Hitler?
Well, it worked very well against not Hitler, it was just a person, but against the Nazi military and then and German occupations. It worked very well where it was tried. The German occupation of Denmark and Norway, in the final years of the war, the Nazis really had no control over anybody. There had been such resistance and non-cooperation, and yes, sabotage as well, but primarily non-violent resistance and non-cooperation, that the people of Denmark and Norway were doing what they chose to do. A number of nations refused to cooperate with shipping their Jewish citizens off to Germany to be killed, some with remarkable success. And when there was resistance to the Nazis in the heart of their empire in Berlin, it was incredibly successful, right? When the women who had Jewish husbands who were locked up and wanted them freed went into the street called Rosenstrasse and began a protest, and other people, random people, who wanted to protest the Nazis took heart and joined in, and it began to grow, the Nazis quickly freed all those men. But then they stopped the protest and went home, and they should have built it, should have enlarged it. The idea that you can't resist an occupation at this point is really ludicrous. After watching what people have done in Puerto Rico and the Philippines temporarily and in Ecuador against U.S. military bases, after watching the Palestinian Intifada grow in the 1980s, after looking at what's been done in the Western Sahara, after looking at Lithuania and Latvia and Estonia under the Soviet occupation, at Lebanon freeing itself of Syrian occupation, at nonviolent resistance against both sides in the past couple of years in Ukraine, unarmed people turning armed troops and tanks out of their towns. You look at what the Germans had done with the French invasion in 1923 of the Ruhr Valley, and with a coup around the same time in Germany, look, of course, at what Gandhi and his allies had done in India against the British. The idea that you can't resist nonviolently is just not tenable anymore, as well as the idea that there is some new Hitler, some new colonial early 1940s European empire about to descend upon us. Right? I mean, Hillary Clinton says that Putin is Hitler. John Kerry says that Assad is Hitler. Slobodan Milosevic, who was just exonerated more or less by the International Court for the crimes that he was demonized for, and he was a nasty guy, but he was falsely demonized, was called Hitler by Tony Blair. Every single enemy that's targeted is called Hitler every single time, but none of them have resembled Hitler. And the idea that there's a new Hitler on the horizon and that somehow justifies preparing for more wars, is just counterproductive.
Very interesting. We're talking with David Swanson of World Beyond War. Tell us again, David, about this conference. We're almost out of time. How people can get in touch with you, and how people can sign up for this conference, and where your books are, especially. We need people to be in touch with this emerging worldview.
Yeah, go to worldbeyondwar.org to find that conference and other events and actions and things you can do. For my personal website, go to davidswanson.org. And if you want to support Colin Kaepernick and others who are sitting down during the national anthem, go to another place I work called rootsaction.org.
I love talking about the national anthem, and Colin Kaepernick, of course, is the quarterback for the San Francisco 49ers, although he'll probably be with a new team soon, maybe in Canada, as a matter of fact. I wouldn't be surprised if he winds up playing in Canada, Colin Kaepernick. He's good, but he's been in decline to a certain extent. My favorite story about the national anthem is that, you know, when Jimi Hendrix played the national anthem at Woodstock, very few people heard it. It was 5 in the morning. But when it came out in the film, people went crazy, and there was a hearing held at Congress, and I watched a documentary where people asked the specific congressman who was so angry about Jimi Hendrix's version of the Star Spangled Banner to recite the words, the Star Spangled Banner, and none of them could do it. This last year I took my daughter downtown to in Columbus, Ohio, to see the fireworks on July 4th. And they played Jimi Hendrix's version of the Star Spangled Banner. I thought, well, that's perfect, you know. So maybe your versions of the Star Spangled Banner and our future as a peace-loving nation will have their time in court. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, those Congress members probably couldn't even do the first verse. I'm not sure I can. I think I could. But even the first verse is about, you know, a war of conquest to take over Canada, and Canada said no thank you, and the White House and Capitol were burned, and it's a song to celebrate the fact that a flag survived a battle that killed human beings. But if you read the other verses that aren't sung, right, there's, you know, a verse celebrating the fact that formerly enslaved people who escaped to go and fight on the British side were being killed, and they deserved it, and ha-ha, what fun to kill them. This by a guy, you know, in the land of the free, you know, Francis Scott Key owned people as slaves. He was a slave owner. He was a district attorney in Washington, D.C., who promoted and defended and celebrated police killings of black people, just like now. And there's an earlier version of the poem set to the same music that celebrated the war on Muslims in the, you know, the Barbary pirates back in the day. So there, you know, there's a history to these lyrics that I think some Congress members, I would hope, would be ashamed to recite if they could, you know.
David, we're getting the call from Pete, from the great beyond, that our hour is almost up. You're a spectacular guest, a wonderful show with David Swanson, author of so many great books. Your website again, one last time, David.
DavidSwanson.org and WorldBeyondWar.org, and thanks for everything you do, Harvey.
All right, you too, buddy. We'll see you soon. Thanks again to the crew in New York for a wonderful hour here at the Soulutopia. We'll see you next week at PRN.